Wyndham Hotels and Resorts makes travel possible for all. Whether it's the long haulers looking for a great cup of coffee, a roomier rest for the on a whim road trippers, or a place to make summer memories with the whole family. No matter who you are, where you're going, or why, with 24 trusted brands to choose from like La Quinta, Days Inn, and Super 8, your Wyndham is waiting. Get the lowest price at WyndhamHotels.com. Restrictions apply. Visit website for more details.
This podcast contains elements that may be alarming to some listeners. Listener discretion is advised.
You are now listening to British Brothers, the True Crime Podcast.
Hello everyone and welcome to British Murders, the podcast focusing exclusively on listener-suggested British murder cases. I'm your host Stuart Blues and this is the second and final part of the Season 12 End of Season Special. I did my icebreakers and facts in Part 1, so I won't be doing those again here. I'm basically going to get straight into the story. Now the end of Part 1 was a bit of a cliffhanger, wasn't it? A few people reached out saying they were fuming they had to wait another week for part two, so I guess it worked as intended. A final reminder, please go and listen to part one if you haven't already. It gives so much context to what I'm about to go through, and without listening to part one, part two won't make any sense. This second part also focuses entirely on the two perpetrators of this story, which I'm not a huge fan of doing these days, but it's needs must. I ended it last week by revealing the name of male number 1594 on Operation Heart's list of almost 5,000 known sex offenders, which they dubbed the Z-Men. John Duffy's place of birth and formative years are a difficult thing to precisely confirm. Many online sources suggest that he was born in 1959, whereas others quote 1958, with November of that year being quoted in one instance. As for where he was born, that has also been widely debated. The common consensus is that he was born in Dundalk in the Republic of Ireland, but several other sources state he simply had Irish parents and was in fact born in England. In the grand scheme of things, such details don't really matter. He would end up moving to Kilburn in London around the age of 6 or 7 anyway, and it was in the nation's capital where he'd stay. Another point to note is that when he was later arrested, his accent was distinctly English with no Irish twang to it whatsoever, but that likely speaks more to the fact he lived here for many years after moving from Ireland, if he did, at such a young age. As a child, he was rather unremarkable. What I mean by that is there was nothing about him that stood out as being a cause for concern. He was your run-of-the-mill boy, especially in those primary school years. One of his teachers described him as being an incredibly sweet boy and noted how he typically kept to himself and didn't get into much trouble. He wasn't a loner as such, but he did often opt to stay away from other kids if he felt he were likely to get into bother by doing so. That was the last thing he wanted. His pleasant and polite demeanour likely came from the upbringing he had with his parents, both of whom were grafters and set the best example possible for their children, of which they had three. Duffy being the eldest. I want you to remember what I've said about his upbringing as I continue the story, because it raises a real question about the whole nature versus nurture debate. Based on the information I've found, there seems to have been no indication that Duffy would go on to become the monster he is. It was only when he turned 11 and began attending Haverstock, a secondary school in the London area of the same name, that things began to take a dark turn. One thing that the bullies at his school pounced on was Duffy's height. He was a small boy, noticeably so when compared to his peers, and even as he grew into adulthood, his height would never exceed 5'4". High school can be brutal, as we all know. The already rather timid and isolated Duffy was an easy target for the older, taller and stronger boys. Combine that with the severe acne on his face and his ginger hair, and you can imagine how some lads at the school will have had a field day with him. Being bullied only sent him further into his shell, which in turn served to further intensify the bullying. It was a vicious cycle that he struggled to get out of. One of his classmates said, He was useless with girls, useless at lessons, and totally uninterested in things like sport and music. No one liked him. He was short and spotty-faced, the sort no one could get on with, and he was always rubbing people up the wrong way. It wasn't until Duffy formed an extremely close bond with one of the few people at school who actually spoke to him that his fortunes changed. That was also the turning point for what would become the realisation and acting out of their respective sick and twisted fantasies. Born in May 1959, also to Irish parents, David Mulcahy was the name of the boy Duffy befriended at Haverstock. Mulcahy was as much of a loner as Duffy, but given he was significantly taller and stockier than his compadre, he essentially took on the role of the smaller boy's bodyguard. The bullies all but stopped their shenanigans when it came to Duffy after that, with the boys left to their own nefarious devices. As is common with those who go on to kill multiple people, the boys began their descent by capturing and torturing any animals they could get their hands on. Mulcahy would later be described by psychologists as being not only the ringleader of the pair, but also the far more violent and sadistic of the two. That's not to say that Duffy was timid during their multiple attacks of women and girls that I discussed in part one, but the common consensus is that Mulcahy was the one in charge. If you're an animal lover, you might want to skip ahead a bit, because this next part involves a hedgehog. An example of Mulcahy's callous behaviour towards animals came when he was just 13, so he'll have been in either year 8 or 9, which is 7th or 8th grade. He had the idea of beating to death a hedgehog by pretending the poor creature was a cricket ball. When threatened, hedgehogs curl up into a ball, which inadvertently made the task much easier for Mulcahy. With his sidekick Duffy stood by his side, laughing hysterically for the duration, Mulcahy repeatedly struck the hedgehog with a plank of wood until it died. He was pretending the wood was a cricket bat. He then stamped on its head, which left him covered in blood. It was his blood-soaked uniform that led to his suspension. The animal cruelty was a way for the boys to hone their skills, with a view to escalating their targets from small animals to women and girls. Duffy appears to have been the one who was entirely driven by a sexual motive, with Mulcahy being more interested in hurting and eventually killing the people they attacked. Having said that, Mulcahy was equally involved when it came to rape, as confirmed in part one. Wanting to prepare themselves as much as possible for what they planned to do when they got older, the boys began to take judo lessons. Not only would it provide them with a physical outlet, it also sharpened their ability to take down a target with ease and keep them restrained if necessary. The 70s and 80s saw karate, judo, and kung fu clubs sprouting up everywhere seemingly overnight in the UK. Bruce Lee's death in July 1973, followed by the release of his last film Enter the Dragon a month later, played a huge part in the kung fu craze, and let's not forget Carl Douglas's smash hit Kung Fu Fighting, released in 1974. Duffy and Mulcahy also reportedly joined the army cadets as teenagers, once more doing their utmost to learn as much combat training as they possibly could. You'll recall in part one how Dr. Peter Venesis, the pathologist who conducted Alison Day's postmortem, said the person involved may have been someone who knew something about the martial arts, or indeed possibly someone who'd been in the armed forces. How right he was. As they entered their later high school years, the two boys would chase terrified girls around the playground, and once caught, they'd be touched inappropriately by the aggressors. Given they were more focused on honing their skills in the cadets and at judo lessons, the boys neglected their schoolwork. Both leaving high school without a single qualification between them, they made an oath to never snitch on the other should they ever be caught during the next few years of planned sexual assaults. The friends were forced to secure jobs to pay their way. Mulcahy secured manual labour roles in the plumbing and decorating trades, with Duffy finding work at a youth club. Remaining as withdrawn as he'd always been, Duffy was noted as being a solid employee who didn't say much and just got on with things. Without Mulcahy by his side, he withdrew back into his shell, only to be coaxed out once more when they met up outside of work. It may sound like I'm hinting at Duffy being led astray by Mulcahy and that he wasn't all that bad on his own. We know for a fact that wasn't the case based on what I told you in part one, so please don't misconstrue what I'm saying there. As they grew into their young adult years, the two's crimes began to escalate. They started terrorising couples on Hampstead Heath by jumping out at them from the bushes, scaring them shitless. They got such a buzz out of their reactions, and it really fuelled their excitement for danger and committing criminal offences. Their first criminal conviction, that I could find at least, was for actual bodily harm, an offence they were arrested for in the autumn of 1976. One Sunday that August, they opened the bathroom window of Mulcahy's parents' home, located above the Prince of Tech pub they were running, and proceeded to fire airgun pellets at passers-by. Four of the five people they shot at ended up in hospital with minor injuries. The deadly duo had also taken to joyriding stolen cars by then. Whilst on a night out in Leicester Square's Empire Ballroom in 1977, Mulcahy met his future wife Sandra, whom he married the following summer. By then working as a plasterer, Mulcahy seemed to have taken the straight and narrow path, with Duffy following suit by securing a role working for British Rail. He was based at London's Euston Station as a member of the company's vehicle and furniture department. I mentioned last week how many of the locations in which women were raped and murdered were very close to railway lines. The reason was due to Duffy's extensive knowledge of the railway network, something learned from his years working for British Rail. He knew where the most isolated parts of the tracks were. He knew which stations were staffed and at what time their shifts finished. He basically had the inside scoop, which helped he and Mulcahy plan their attacks so they could take place in areas where it was highly unlikely they'd be seen or disturbed. Like Mulcahy, Duffy also got married. His wife, a woman called Margaret, was someone he met at an ice rink whilst he caused havoc with his best buddy. The two men would intentionally barge into other skaters, primarily women, for nothing more than shits and giggles. Duffy married Margaret at Camden Register Office in 1980, with the pair moving in together some months later. In 1981, Duffy and Mulcahy received suspended sentences after being caught nicking a load of alcohol from a storeroom somewhere, likely from a pub. By then, both 22, each of them had made efforts to have kids with their respective wives, but only Mulcahy was successful. Duffy would later see a specialist about the couple's difficulty in conceiving a child, with the results coming back showing he had a low sperm count. Settling instead on a puppy, an Alsatian they named Toby, Duffy's frustrations were sadly taken out at first on the dog. While Margaret tended to Toby's every whim, treating him essentially as if he were a child, Duffy was the complete opposite. Abusing the animal on a regular basis, Toby would eventually die after somehow falling from the roof of Duffy and Margaret's flat. How exactly he came to be up there, I can't say, but my guess would be that Duffy had a hand in it, and perhaps the term falling isn't quite accurate. That's just conjecture, though. Duffy's growing personal problems came to a head in 1982, when he supposedly made an attempt to take his own life. It must have been within the first 6 months of that year, because as we know, he and Mulcahy began officially raping women that June. After the first known attack on June 10th, the two men reconfirmed their pact to never snitch on each other and remarked just how easy it had been. Excited to continue, they carried on doing so. Remember how I said the rapes appeared to suddenly stop for 6 months in July 1983? That was because of the marital problems between Duffy and Margaret becoming more and more prevalent. The recurring issues culminated with Margaret leaving Duffy at the end of the year, which ties in with the rapes recommencing in January 1984. In the summer of that year, Duffy lost his job at British Rail, where he by then worked as a carpenter. He turned up so infrequently that the firm saw no need to continue employing him. A combination of his marital problems and the previous sexual assaults likely led to his mind being focused on things other than work. But his firing didn't make much of a difference to the attacks or the locations in which they took place. Duffy's knowledge of the railway network was cemented by that point, and he continued to ride the rails completely free of charge by using his work's rail pass. That October, Duffy and Mulcahy were stopped while the latter drove them around in his car. In the vehicle was a plethora of stolen goods, primarily building materials, with the pair receiving court-ordered fines a few days later. Also in the car was a balaclava, which the arresting officer thought peculiar, but Mulcahy explained it away as being an item he used whilst working as a plasterer to stop any dust particles from being breathed in. The officer had no idea of the mask's true purpose. Duffy then reportedly began assaulting and raping women on his own in November 1984, something that continued into the following year. He'd say he was off out jogging in the evening and wouldn't return for sometimes 4 hours or more. I believe by that point he'd secured a role working for Westminster City Council. Mulcahy soon joined him by securing a role of his own there at Duffy's request.
The story will continue after these quick messages. And now, back to the story.
Margaret seems to have got back with Duffy at some point around then, but ultimately left him once more in June 1985. I don't believe they got divorced, but Margaret had had enough of Duffy's violent tendencies. The depth of his physical abuse was revealed when Margaret said, "Once he forced a handkerchief down my throat. He said he had something nice for me. I thought it was a piece of cake, but he pushed a handkerchief in and then held me. He squeezed his hands around my throat and I pushed him off. He later apologised and said he didn't know what had come over him. I thought he was going to kill me." The month after Margaret left him, Duffy paid her a visit at the home of her friend Imray, who'd kindly taken her in. Armed with a knife, Duffy threatened Imray and assaulted her boyfriend before raping Margaret. The attacks were reported soon after they occurred, which led to Duffy's swift arrest. I want to point out that in 1985, it was not illegal for a husband to rape his wife in the UK. It became illegal in 1992, a mere 22 years ago. I say that because Duffy was charged not with the rape of his wife, he was charged only with causing grievous bodily harm regarding Imray and her boyfriend. All Margaret could do was take out an injunction against her husband that prevented him from going anywhere nearer. As for whether he listened to it, that would depend entirely on Duffy. Whilst in court, officers working the Operation Heart case took one of the women raped by Duffy to see if she recognised him. Identifying him would have helped them narrow in on the person responsible, but despite unknowingly staring into the eyes of the man who had raped her, the woman was unable to recognise him. Duffy no doubt recognised her, though. Remember, this was back when identity parades allowed the perpetrators to see the witnesses' faces. They were in the same room, which some believe led to Duffy suggesting to Mulcahy that leaving their victims alive was perhaps too much of a risk. Duffy remained in prison until September, when he was released on bail. Instead of using the experience of being sent to prison as an opportunity to become rehabilitated, Duffy instead used some of the forensic knowledge gleaned to his advantage. Carrying on his solo raping spree, he would now order the women to comb their pubic hair after the attack to ensure any hairs he may have shed were removed. That was something he learned after raping Margaret. When he raped a woman in November 1985, it appeared on the following month's edition of Crime Watch, but despite the victim providing an excellent description of her attacker, nothing came of it. That same month, December 1985, Duffy was back in court, this time on domestic abuse charges. He appears to have spent some more time in custody, but it can't have been longer than a few weeks before being bailed, because it was on the 29th of that month when he and Mulcahy murdered 19-year-old Alison Day. Marcia Tamboza was then killed in April 1986, with Anne Locke murdered just over a month after that. On May 17th, the day before Anne was killed, Duffy was arrested, believe it or not. The offence this time was loitering by a railway station. On his person was a knife. Despite his arrest being placed on file, he was released after explaining to the arresting officer that he carried a knife because he was undergoing weapons training. That arrest, combined with the previous rape of his wife, even though he wasn't formally charged with that, put him on the police's radar as a sex offender. Therefore, he was placed on Operation Heart's extensive Z-Men list. As they worked through it, men were called in to provide blood samples, which would then be forensically checked and compared to samples recovered from the various crime scenes. When Duffy got the call, he chose to attend his police interview with a solicitor present. The solicitor advised that his client would not be offering a sample of his blood, but the interviewers were more concerned with Duffy's appearance. It matched several descriptions provided by some of the women he'd raped, making him even more of a suspect than he already was. Just one day removed from that interview, Duffy found himself in hospital. The officers who'd interviewed him had raised their concerns to their superiors, and the decision was made to bring him back for further questioning. Everyone was shocked not only that he was in hospital, but that he claimed to have amnesia and couldn't remember a thing. Doctors at Free and Barnet Hospital refused to allow Duffy to be questioned further given his current state, which was awfully convenient. Putting his questioning on the back burner, the officers turned to the rest of the men on their list. A series of bizarre instances hindered the investigation further, such as officers falsely believing the rapist to be a jockey, given his short stature, as described by most of the women he raped, and a newspaper printing an article about a surveillance operation taking place on unmanned railway stations. The initially covert operation had to be abandoned as a result, as the rapist now knew he was being watched. Here's where the story made a bit of history. For the first time ever in Britain, a professor of psychology from the University of Surrey called Dr. David Cantor was brought in to create a psychological profile of the railway rapist. Offender profiling was popularised in the USA in the 1970s by Robert Ressler and John E. Douglas, the latter of whom released a book about their groundbreaking work titled Mindhunter, inside the FBI's elite serial crime unit. The Netflix series Mindhunter is based on that book. Dr. Cantor was shown witness reports from the rape victims and managed to piece together a profile of the perpetrator. He listed 17 points or traits which he felt the rapist had, and when ran against the names on the Z-Men list, 13 of those 17 matched John Duffy. Such traits were where he lived, him being a semi-skilled worker, him having marital problems, and only having a very small yet close circle of friends. Duffy was placed under surveillance as a result of Dr. Cantor's work, but he soon cottoned on to the fact he was being watched. He did his utmost to throw off the tails placed on him by slipping down alleyways or waiting until the last second to jump on a train as its doors closed before setting off. In a last-ditch effort to change his appearance and throw the police off for good, Duffy shaved his moustache. He was arrested on November 26, 1986, after Chief Superintendent John Hurst explained to his team that he didn't feel comfortable at the chance of further rapes and murders occurring while the key suspect was under police surveillance. At the time of his arrest, Duffy was stalking a woman in a park that was incredibly secluded. Who knows what he'd have done to her had he not been stopped? When questioned, he remained silent for the most part, instead opting to stare out the interviewers with a look so cold it made them feel incredibly uncomfortable. That same dead-eyed stare was reported by many of his victims as being something he did during the assaults. Margaret was brought in for questioning whilst their home was searched, and she revealed just how dark Duffy's sexual tendencies were. She also explained that he enjoyed watching violent martial arts movies and the video nasties of the 1980s. During the house search, officers recovered several knives and bizarre reading material, including something called the Anarchist Cookbook. That's a book which details how to manufacture explosives and weapons, whilst also providing detailed descriptions of hostage-taking techniques. Margaret also told the officers that Duffy had once arrived home and confessed to having raped a girl. He then proceeded to blame Margaret for having done so. One of two key pieces of evidence came when officers searched the home of Duffy's parents. That elusive ball of somyarn that I discussed in part one was recovered, and it matched the sample taken from Marty's murder. Margaret had acquired the ball from Sunlight Laundries, a place she worked at. The other crucial evidence came in the form of testimony from a man called Ross Mockridge. He was a friend of Duffy's who admitted to having assaulted him at his request the day after he was asked to give a blood sample. That all but confirmed that Duffy had faked amnesia after getting his mate to very carefully beat him up. Even after five of Duffy's victims picked him out at identity parades, he maintained his innocence and insisted he was being framed. Alison Day's murder was linked to Duffy next when some fibres recovered from his clothing matched those recovered from her jacket. With him now in the frame for Martia and Alison's murders, detectives were still left with the task of pinning him to Anne's. Duffy's murder trial began in February 1988, and it was during it that four of his rape victims testified against him, one of whom was just 14 years old. Found guilty by the jury of those four rapes and two murders, those of Alison and Martia, Duffy had indeed seemingly gotten away with having raped and murdered Anne Locke. A series of avoidable mishaps led to Anne's body not being discovered for 9 weeks, at which point her body was so badly decomposed that she could only be identified by her dental records. Hertfordshire Police and the Metropolitan Police each thought the other was going to cover the 200-metre section of train track where Anne's body was dumped, but neither of them did so as a result of thinking the other one was going to do it. That simple miscommunication led to Duffy not being charged with her murder. Any evidence that would have linked him to the crime had been destroyed by the elements by the time her body was found. Duffy gave his dead-eyed stare to the judge as he was handed a 30-year prison sentence, but what about Mulcahy? Surely he didn't get off scot-free. You're right, he didn't, although it would take a good decade before he was placed behind bars. In 1997, whilst in HMP Whitemore, Duffy told a prison psychologist that he hadn't acted alone. Dr. Jenny Cutler was the head of forensic psychology at the prison, and her first meeting with Duffy took place in November of that year. As their conversations continued and Duffy became more comfortable, he revealed that his accomplice was not housed in another prison. Rather, he was a free man. With Mulcahy's name now on file, concerns were raised that he was continuing to rape women after 4 incidents were documented as having occurred in areas close to where the initial rapes took place. Each was at knife point, with the attacker surprising the women from behind, but DNA recovered led to no matches. That ruled out Duffy, given he was locked up, but the police had no record of Mulcahy's DNA on file, so they brought him in for questioning. At first, not being comfortable enough to provide a blood sample, Mulcahy ripped out a chunk of his own hair and handed it to the officers after being informed that a hair sample would suffice. The 4 rapes I've just mentioned turned out not to have been committed by him, but in 1998, 14 years after the rapes of the 2 Danish au pairs I discussed in part 1, Mulcahy's DNA was found to match semen recovered from 1 of the 18-year-olds. The chances of the semen belonging to anyone other than Mulcahy were 1 in 51 million. Further forensic breakthroughs occurred, including recovering Mulcahy's fingerprints from 2 separate pieces of tape used in the rapes to cover the victims' mouths. We now arrive at February 2, 2001. That was the day the jury returned to the courtroom at the Old Bailey after considering the 15 charges placed against Mulcahy. They found him guilty of 7 counts of rape, 5 counts of conspiracy to rape, and 3 counts of murder. Judge Mr. Michael Higham handed Mulcahy 3 life sentences for the murders, 24 years for each of the rapes, and 18 years for each of the conspiracy to rape charges. All sentences were to be served concurrently. In March 2001, Duffy voluntarily admitted to 17 more rapes and was sentenced to a further 12 years in prison. By his own admission, Duffy is unsure of just how many women he has raped. And that concludes this end of season special. Thanks again, Matthew, Stephanie, Michelle and Chris for requesting that case. I'd love to hear everyone's thoughts on it. I read some reviews out in part 1, so I'll omit that portion this week. Hello and welcome to my newest Patreon members, Bibby, Jen Cooper, Holly McElwee and Naomi Jones. Those of you who joined either my OBE or CBE tier will have your welcome goodies arriving in the post soon. Please continue emailing case suggestions to contact@britishmurders.com or message me via social media. You'll not only get the episode covered, but you'll get a cheeky shout out too. And thus concludes another season. I've been Stuart Blues. This has been British Murders. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time. Cheerio.